This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Disturbing allegations that Russia put a bounty on the heads of American soldiers. An ex-CIA chief and former commander of U.S. forces in Afghanistan weighs in.
If the degree of confidence is sufficient, clearly we should have conveyed to the Russians how outrageous and unacceptable this is.
I'm Marco Werman. Also today, Iran reopens and sees a surge in COVID-19.
As you can see, there is no magic medication to wipe away the illness.
And we go to North Korea, where Kim Jong-un's half-sister is a rising star.
Everyone inside North Korea knows that she is number two.
But how much can she influence war and peace? And all those critters you're now seeing more of, lockdowns make studying them easier. All that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. An explosive story on Afghanistan that is not going away. The New York Times reported this weekend that Russia secretly offered bounties to Taliban-linked fighters to kill American soldiers. President Trump says the intelligence community did not brief him on the allegations because they didn't find the reports credible. Taliban spokesperson Suhail Shaheen denied the reports.
I refute this report. It is not true. It is only to create confusion and to derail the peace process.
David Petraeus, a retired U.S. Army general and former CIA chief, is not surprised by the reports of Russian bounties.
We were looking for this kind of activity, frankly, from Russia, also, by the way, from Iran and from some other countries in the region and other entities. We looked for any support that the Russians might be providing to not just the Taliban, but perhaps some of the other extremist and insurgents organizations. But certainly, according to the various news sources that clearly have been briefed on this by folks inside the community, it appears that this certainly took place during 2019.
So based on what you've read and heard so far, do you believe the reports of the Russian bounties are true?
There's quite a bit of detail about the cache of money that was captured in a raid and then followed up with information during interrogation of individuals that were detained during those operations. And indeed, it appears, apparently, that there was at least one American soldier for whom this bounty was paid out. Keep in mind that we are many months after an agreement between the U.S. and Taliban representatives back in February. Since then, reportedly, there have been no Taliban attacks on U.S. positions. So we're really looking back at something that took place rather than something that has been taking place recently. That doesn't mean that it is not absolutely outrageous, unacceptable, reprehensible. But if the degree of confidence is sufficient, we should have conveyed to the Russians how outrageous and unacceptable this is.
Intelligence officials told the AP that President Trump was briefed on the bounty matter earlier this year, but Trump is now trying to swat those allegations aside, tweeting last night that the intelligence community told him he was not briefed about these allegations because intelligence officials did not find the reports credible. What do you make of that?
Well, who knows? And, you know, you can parse words and so forth. Very difficult to know whether this was in the presidential daily briefing or in one of the actual sessions that was held with the National Security Council or with the president.
If the Russians were offering bounties for the lives of U.S. troops, how will Washington respond to this?
One would hope that perhaps there already had been a response, but if not, then clearly there are various options, everything from a diplomatic outreach to them about how unacceptable this is, how reprehensible, and then on up the ladder, whether it's clandestine operations, covert action, and not just in Afghanistan, although certainly if this were discovered there, there should be some pretty substantial targeting against those who were engaged in it. But of course, there are Russian forces operating in southeastern Ukraine. There are forces in Syria. There are proxies in various other places around the world where, if necessary, something further could be pursued.
If there was already a response, what would it have been?
There is some speculation that this is a bit of a payback for what you may recall taking place a few years ago in northeastern Syria, where some Russian proxies, essentially the Wagner group, this is a security contract group with some Syrian forces, crossed in a very menacing formation with some very substantial weapons, crossed into what was accepted as the Syrian Democratic Forces zone where the U.S. was supporting them. And there were warnings given. When those forces did not turn around, the U.S. hammered them with precision air attacks and so forth. Again, it's possible that this is some kind of payback for that, except that, again, that was a violation of what was understood to be respective spheres within Syria.
General, what should U.S. troops on the ground make of all this? What is the message it's sending to the boots on the ground?
Clearly, there's always a desire and a need to know that those above you, if you will, have your back. And that will be among the factors, I'm sure, as this is evaluated further and as additional actions are taken.
David Petraeus is a retired U.S. Army general. He served as director of the Central Intelligence Agency, the U.S. Central Command, and the International Security Assistance Force. General, thank you very much.
Pleasure. Thanks, Marco.
Opening up the economy and managing coronavirus infections is a tough balancing act. We're learning that lesson here in the U.S. with spiking infection rates in a number of states. In Iran, an early hotspot for the virus, authorities decided to open things up after 4 months of emergency lockdown. What followed has also been a big spike in infections. The World's Shirin Jafari reports.
Salome Zarandinia is a makeup artist in Iran. Back in March, she was well on her way to realizing her long-time dream. I always wanted to open up my own beauty salon, she tells me in a call from Tehran. For years, she'd saved up money to start her own business. She'd even picked a name, Audrey, after her favorite actress, Audrey Hepburn.
متاسفانه اتفاقی که افتاد به محض اینکه من قرارداد سالونم رو امضا کردم 3 روز بعدش
3 days after Zarandinia signed the lease on her new salon, the country went into lockdown.
دیگه خلاصه خیلی مشکلات داشتم.
She says it felt like the rug had been pulled from under her feet. Iran reported its first cases back in February. By the end of March, it recorded more than 3,000 new infections in a single day. Dr. Puya Payandemir is the head of emergency care at Sina Hospital in Tehran. He says the lockdown might have come late, but it did save lives.
We had a few number of patients during past months. We had daily one or two patients most.
In April, he says, the number of new cases went down. So his hospital started to dismantle the coronavirus triage section. But he suspected it wasn't over.
Opening of a routine activity of citizens and opening the jobs and shops and restaurants and everything else, it causes people to be in the city again without keeping away from each other. And the protective policies are not respected that much.
But for Salome Zarandinia, the makeup artist, the reopening was good news. After 4 months of waiting, she could finally open her salon. She was nervous at first. What if somebody got sick, she wondered.
یعنی مثلا روزی سه تا مشتری کلن با فاصله خیلی زیاد می گرفتیم.
She says she takes safety precautions seriously, requires everyone to wear masks, wash their hands before and after each client. It's a lot of work to survive as a business in this pandemic, she says. For example, the other day, a client called her to ask how she's going to disinfect the lipstick she's going to be using on her.
ما روژ لب مستقیم به لب مشتری نمیزنیم.
We never apply lipstick directly, she told her. We use a spatula just once and disinfect it if we need to use it again. But even if businesses are cautious, Iran has seen a dramatic spike in cases. Mahdiyar Saidian is a physician and medical activist in the city of Mashhad. He says ICU beds are filling up again, ventilators are working full speed, and the numbers are not good. According to Iran's health ministry, infections in the first week of June jumped 50% compared to the week before. Saidian says healthcare workers are exhausted.
He
says he knows of at least 135 health workers who have died of COVID-19 and about 4,000 who have contracted the virus. And there's another worrying trend. Last week, an anesthesiologist posted a video on social media claiming that relatives of a coronavirus patient attacked and beat him badly. Dr. Saidian says people are on edge, and Iran is not even close to the end of this pandemic. Puya Payandemir, the doctor in Tehran, tells me it's unlikely that things will fully get back to normal anytime soon.
We are dealing with a situation that will last for 1 or 2 years. As you can see, there is no magic medication to wipe away the illness.
Just because everyone is exhausted, he says, doesn't mean this global pandemic is over. For the world, I'm Shirin Jafari.
Pumas roaming the empty streets of Santiago in Chile, dolphins in the unusually calm waters off of Trieste in Italy. Jackals are roaming city parks in Tel Aviv in broad daylight. The lockdown on human movements during the pandemic has also changed the way wildlife is behaving. Christian Roots is an evolutionary ecologist at the University of St. Andrews in Scotland. He's proposing a global research effort to study this changed behavior. So you've coined this phenomenon as the anthropause, a pause in human activity. So it's been fascinating to watch from a human perspective, but how significant is this period for wildlife?
It provides a fantastic opportunity for researchers to find out more about human and wildlife interactions. And I should say at the outset, it's an opportunity that has come about by the most tragic circumstances, but we feel it's one we can't afford to miss. We are proposing to use tiny little tracking devices, which wildlife biologists have fitted to animals all over the world, to learn more about how wildlife responded to this drastic and sudden reduction to modern human mobility during the anthropause.
So what kinds of things are scientists starting to learn about animal behaviors during this natural experiment?
So we have just launched this initiative, and we have put out a call to the international research community to help us by sharing the data. So we are at the launch stage of this project. Unfortunately, I don't have firm answers for you yet. But we put out this call, and we're overwhelmed by the enthusiastic response we got from scientists around the world. And so we know we've got the data, but now it's time for us to analyze these data and look for these effects some people have predicted. But what is important to us is that once we have answers, we want to turn those into policy recommendations going forward, looking at ways of how we can structure our modern human lives in a way that is beneficial for the planet and for us. But we don't have answers yet. You will have to wait another few weeks or months, and I'm happy to come back onto the show then.
Well, we would love to have you. Let me ask you this, because there are hundreds of ongoing research projects on animal movement around the world. Are there any studies that you're watching closely?
The really exciting thing about this initiative is that it provides this umbrella for all these different studies to come together and contribute data. And I have to say, these studies, they were all initially launched as independent research projects. So these were biologists that studied their chosen study species, put tracking devices on animals, and then COVID-19 happened. Nobody saw that coming, but these devices kept delivering data. And now, in this period of crisis, all these colleagues have decided, rather than pursuing their independent research projects, it's better to pull resources together and do these global collaborative analyses.
Christian, for you personally, once the lockdown started, was there kind of a eureka moment when you realized that there was an opportunity to really better understand animal movement?
I remember when I was permitted to go for a brief walk a day with my family here in Scotland. For the very first time in our local village, we saw a pair of ravens. Mm. We've been living here for 8 years and have never seen ravens. So this was a first personal glimpse of something changing in nature and where we live.
Christian Roots is an evolutionary ecologist at the University of St. Andrews in Scotland. Christian, thanks very much for being with us. Great to speak with you.
Thanks for having me. Thanks.
You're listening to The World.
Support for The World comes from Odoo. What is Odoo? Well, Odoo is the only software your business will ever need. Featuring a suite of integrated business applications, Odoo connects your business operations together so you can get more done in less time. Odoo has apps for everything: CRM, accounting, sales, HR, inventory, marketing, manufacturing, you name it. Odoo's got it. To learn more, visit odoo.com/theworld. That's odoo.com/theworld.
I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Consumer giant Unilever is dropping the word fair from its Fair and Lovely brand of skin lightening products. These creams, mostly, have long been criticized for promoting the idea that lighter skin is better, and for the very real health risks some of them pose. But these products have remained big business in India and other parts of South Asia and Africa. Now the global Black Lives Matter movement has pushed Unilever to change the name of the product line, but not take it off of shelves. Mumbai-based documentarian Richa Sanwal has tackled colorism in her work. She joins me from Mumbai. Richa, a lot of the popularity of skin lightening creams in India can be attributed to some pretty aggressive marketing campaigns. What do these ads for these products look like?
These ads basically target vulnerabilities and your insecurities that you have. So, for example, the ads are pegged in a way that, you know, if you want to be successful professionally, you go for a job interview and, you know, you're not light skinned, so you're not able to get that job. Mm. Similarly, even you know, we have arranged marriages in India, and a lot of times there are these concepts around arranged marriages as well, where the groom wants a fair skin or lighter skin girl as the bride. So the ads are sort of shown on TV in a way that you cannot get a spouse because you're not light skinned. And these prejudices really play on your mind, especially as a young child.
So your idea of how lighter skin promotes economic advantages for some people. We both are looking at a commercial right now, in fact, a Fair and Lovely ad. A great example of this, the dancer. So describe what's happening in this commercial and how it fits into the wider messaging about skin color in India.
There is a group of dancers, you know, who are dancing, and, you know, the one who's actually performing better is on the sidelines because she's darker skinned, and the one who's probably not performing as well, but because, you know, she has the advantage of having a lighter skin tone, is put right in the middle of the, you know, of the group. So, you know, this is what they're trying to show you through this ad, that, you know, you will not get those opportunities because you don't have the, you know, the desirable skin tone.
Typically, who uses these products? Is it all classes of Indian society? And do you have a sense of how people across India are reacting to the shift in branding?
People all across the spectrum here use these creams, from your, you know, house help, that, you know, it's a very common practice here in India. You have house help. And that's something that I covered even in the documentary that I made, in all fairness. You know, your house help to your CEO of a company. Fair and Lovely, of course, has been around since 1975. But in 2005, Fair and Handsome was also launched to sort of target the men, you know, sort of selling that same dream to men as well, that, you know, hey, you need to also get a lighter skin tone in order to succeed in life.
Do you have a sense then of how people across India are reacting to the shift in branding?
You know, as you know, Hindustan Unilever, that manufactures Fair and Lovely, the iconic cream brand that I mentioned.
Right.
They've decided to drop the word fair, white, and light from their branding entirely. I do think it is a symbolic message and a step in the right direction. However, you know, a lot of us here feel like that's not entirely addressing the social stigma that comes with these creams, because essentially you're still selling a fairness cream brand, just packaging it as not Fair and Lovely, but whatever else they come up with, they're still sort of mulling over that. You know, there are alternatives being thrown, like Glow and Lovely. And so essentially you're still selling that same dream, just packaging it differently. We welcome the decision. It's definitely a huge step. But I think there's a lot more that needs to be done in order to sort of really eradicate the prejudice and the stigma that plagues the Indian society.
I want to get back to the attitudes in a moment, but we should also mention the health issues here as well. What are the health risks of these products?
Fair and Lovely has been around for a long time. We've all used it. So there hasn't been any grave health risks as such. But I know that there are bleaching creams that a lot of Indians use, and those can be really bad for your skin. And I will talk from my own personal experience. Growing up, I was told that, you know, you need to use this bleaching cream because, you know, you have facial hair or because you're not, you know, you're not fair. I used that cream and I remember my skin burning and I vowed to never use it again.
When you were a journalism student in New York a few years ago, you produced a documentary where you spoke with family members, your own family, about how their comments about your skin tone affected you as a child. I want us just to hear a moment of that, of you as an 8-year-old playing at a family wedding, very happily.
Look how happy and cheery I am. Only because I thought I had outdone my light-skinned cousins. We were normally pitted against each other in every aspect of life. But the one that bothered me the most was our skin color.
Richa, your grandmother especially commented on your skin color, comparing it to that of your cousins who had lighter skin. What impact did that have on you?
They were lighter skin than I was. And if you see the clip, you'd notice that the difference is not very stark. It's not like I'm many shades darker than them. But, you know, here it's even one shade darker can have, you know, an effect on your mind, because my grandmom sort of, my grandmom is obviously old. She was born during British colonial period when the British were still ruling India. And I think it comes from there, you know, that white is superior and you know, being light skinned is the way to be. And my grandmom would inevitably just keep comparing me to my lighter skinned cousins. And that's why I decided to use those creams myself, you know, in order to please her and to get validation from people around me, just to be called pretty, like my cousins. So it definitely, you know, has an effect on your mind. And I confronted my grandmom when I was shooting this documentary, and she was so surprised that, you know, this had such a grave impact on me. She did not realize that.
So coming back to some of these attitudes that kind of make these products popular in the first place, even if Fair is no longer part of the brand, skin lightening products are still being made and it's still called Lovely and still on shelves. But what's being done to change the perceptions, do you think, and educate the public about colorism?
Yeah, and you know, that is such a good question, Marco, because I really think that, Black Lives Matter protests, and you talked about it in the beginning. I think that is such a strong messaging, and a lot of us are internally looking at our own prejudices now. A lot of Bollywood actors who endorse these fairness cream brands were called out after Black Lives Matter protests began in the US and of course, all across the world about their own hypocrisy, because they were all supporting Black Lives Matter movement. But at the same time, the same actors were also endorsing fairness cream brands. So I really hope that, you know, the awareness that we're trying to spread, I do know that it's a long road ahead for us. And to sort of, you know, shatter that conditioning and stigma completely will take a lot of time.
Documentarian Richa Sanwal speaking with us from Mumbai. In All Fairness is the documentary she produced. You can watch it at theworld.org. Richa, thank you very much. Good to meet you.
Thank you, Marco.
No doubt you've noticed there is a lot of news these days. Here's one more way you can keep up with what we're following. Start your morning with a quick hit of news stories from around the globe. Sign up for our morning newsletter, Top of the World, on our website, theworld.org/newsletters. Again, that's theworld.org/newsletters. Black Lives Matter in Italy. An Afro-Italian singer has long felt people there don't see her. And then she wrapped herself in the country's flag at a concert.
I remember the crowd looking at me like, oh my God, she's doing that. The black girl wearing the Italian flag, you know, so it was very provocative.
That's coming up right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH Boston, and PRX. Not so long ago, she was an obscure figure, but now Kim Yo-jong is one of the most famous North Koreans alive. She's the half-sister of North Korea's Supreme Leader Kim Jong-un. Her influence in the regime has been hyped up by rumors, but as The World's Patrick Nguyen reports, it's becoming clear that Kim Yo-jong really does have a lot of power.
Kim Yo-jong has been on a roll lately. This month, under her guidance, North Korea blew up an office on its own soil where they usually meet with officials from South Korea. kind of like deleting someone's number from your phone, but more dramatic.
우리 측 해당 부문에서는 개성 공업지구에 있던 동남 공동연락사무소를
That was the propaganda department where Kim Yo-jong is a top leader, bragging about the explosion on North Korean TV. Then came what she called a, quote, bomb of words, a letter that amounted to a big middle finger to South Korea's president, saying he's like a dreamy-eyed little boy. She's annoyed that his talk of peace, of getting Donald Trump to end sanctions, it's not going fast enough. What is going quite well, however, is Kim Yo-jong's career.
She is really now the number two figure in North Korea after her brother.
That's Lee Sung-hyun. He's an analyst at the Sejong Institute in Seoul. And not so long ago, Lee says, this is what the very old, very male North Korean leadership thought of her.
That she was a woman, she was inexperienced, she is too young.
Now she seems untouchable. Personally insulting heads of state, that's an honor usually reserved for the regime leader. She's even been writing letters to Donald Trump. Also, in overseeing that demolition of the liaison office, she was kind of ordering a military strike, something Professor Lee says a general would do. I asked Lee if North Koreans could still criticize her for her gender, her age, or if they would get in trouble.
Not just trouble, probably, you know, you're not going to have your neck the next morning.
Kim Yo-jong is building her reputation, a phase everyone in the Kim regime goes through. Kim Jong-un, he is linked to a submarine strike 10 years ago on a South Korean Navy ship. Nearly 50 sailors died, and his tough guy reputation went up. This recent explosion, courtesy of Kim Yo-jong, says to the world, hey, I may be just in my early 30s, but make room. My brother's got my back. Respect my name.
Everyone inside North Korea knows that she is number two. Just like in a conglomerate, everyone knows who is the chairman's son or daughter, and you don't touch him or her because the chairman is grooming the person who is young. Their position will get elevated very soon.
Yet for someone so famous, Kim Yo-jong is still mysterious. She can charm foreign leaders in person, but she prefers to communicate through letters, some of them vicious, basically poetic death threats. But Kim Yo-jong doesn't do televised speeches, or any speeches, actually. I looked for a clip of her voice and only found this from 2 years ago. She's shaking hands with South Korean President Moon Jae-in for the cameras. Did you hear it? That female voice drowned out by camera shutters? That's her. Lee Sung-hyun says the strategy is keep people talking about you, but mostly hang behind the curtain.
When you get to hear Kim Yo-jong's voice, it's an encounter with a celebrity, encounter with a deity, because you don't normally hear their voice.
So what's next for North Korea's rising star? While her main job is still in the propaganda department, Lee thinks she'll move on to something bigger soon. And he says she does have a lot more to prove.
She will be much more tempted to engineer a crisis to establish her authority.
As for the rumor that made her famous, that she'll take the throne if her brother falls ill, well, Lee says, just speculating here, that since Kim Jong-un supposedly has 3 young sons, it's more likely his sister would help groom one of them to be leader.
Usually, the crown will go to the prince. So Kim Yo-jong, in the absence of Kim Jong-un, Kim Yo-jong is more like a guardian.
But who knows? Just expect to hear more from Kim Yo-jong. More fireworks to boost her reputation. It's all part of her plan. For the world, I'm Patrick Nguyen.
George Floyd's last words were, "I can't breathe." They were also the last words, also caught on camera, of Cédric Chauviat. He's a delivery man who was killed by police in a chokehold in Paris in January. Chauviat's case and the death of another black Frenchman named Adama Traoré are now being reinvestigated. France's colonial history, systemic racism, and police brutality are also being scrutinized. Malik Njai is the director of the French in France and Africa program at Seattle University. He says the discussion in France centers partly around police chokeholds, which were temporarily banned but are now permitted again.
If you take the chokehold and do not link it with a racial issue, you miss the target, you know? And the question was not how this could be a potential threat to minorities. and how that ban would contribute to save some Black or Arab lives. That's something the public opinion is not open as a debate. It seemed to me that police brutality is not tackled in France in terms of race or ethnicity, and that's probably the main issue we have here. France doesn't allow ethnic statistics. The society is also believing that there is no racism because of that in France.
And if so you ask, what does that mean, that France doesn't take kind of a census on who is who?
Yes, exactly. And if you ask any French national, they will probably tell you, look, we are not a racist country. You know, France has been promoting equality since the revolution.
So can France progress without changing the law and recognizing people's identity?
Definitely yes, because the problem is not the law, the problem is the education. How can we educate people to be more aware of racism and how it affects minorities? I think the people we've seen talking in the media in France about George Floyd's case were the same one who talk about race and racism in France, and they have no experience.
We're seeing people taking to the streets in Paris, across France, on behalf of these two men, Cédric Chauviat and Adama Traoré, who were killed. Is this a moment of reckoning for France, do you think?
Definitely. And that's probably what would make us a little bit more optimistic. The youth, they are more connected with social media. They are more informed about racial dynamics all over the world. And they want to be part of the change.
So is that conversation starting?
Definitely, yes. But the problem is the voices from the minorities are still silenced in a way. So the experience of racism is not described by the person who are really enduring it. And that would be part of the problem. Because if you want to talk about an issue, you also want to put a dynasty on that.
El Hadji Malik Ndiaye is the director of French in France and Africa program at Seattle University. Malik, thank you very much for your time.
You're welcome.
The reckoning with racism is happening in many countries. It's happening across businesses and organizations. That includes within the environmental movement. It's long been criticized for being too white. And now a generation of young activists is pushing for racial equity to be a core part of the movement. The world's Anna Kusmer has more.
When Dorcita Taylor was in college in the early 80s, she looked around her ecology class and realized she was the only Black person in the room.
And I asked the professor, why aren't there more Black students in the course? And he promptly, without even taking a breath, said, because Blacks are not interested in the environment.
Taylor says this ran counter to everything she knew. In her home country, Jamaica, people from all backgrounds were passionate about nature.
So after that class, I went to the library because I thought, he has to be wrong. And every article I pulled said exactly what he said. Blacks are not interested in the environment. And so that really stuck with me.
Taylor says she knew this stereotype wasn't true and largely stemmed from systemic racism, keeping people of color out of the mainstream environmental movement. Later, in her work as a professor of environmental racism at the University of Michigan, she found similar underrepresentation existed at environmental organizations in the U.S.
When I did a national study, several hundred environmental organizations, we found about just under 16% people of color in the organizations.
That's compared to around 35% of the population. Likewise, in the UK, the environmental sector, including jobs at environmental NGOs and in environmental management, is one of the least diverse sectors of the economy. And that's been coming up a lot amid the global Black Lives Matter protests following George Floyd's death. It's amplified calls for environmental organizations to focus more on environmental injustice, how people of color are disproportionately impacted by pollution and climate change. In the past few weeks, big green groups, including Greenpeace and 350.org, have responded. They've released statements, videos, and op-eds supporting Black Lives Matter and calling for racial justice. But environmental activist Suzanne Dhaliwal is skeptical that this will translate into real inclusion for people of color.
I think we're in a very difficult moment where it looks diverse, you know, our pictures are used, but however, in terms of access to resources, to having a say on the strategies that are used, I think it's at an all-time low.
Dhaliwal identifies as British, Indian, Canadian, and Sikh. She spent much of her 20s working with big environmental nonprofits in the UK. She grew frustrated when she couldn't get them interested in partnering with Indigenous communities. So she decided to start her own environmental nonprofit. And now she encourages other young people of color to do the same.
Now what I call for is direct funding of Black and Brown and Indigenous organizations, leadership training.
Resources going directly to the most impacted communities.
We need research money so that we can research new strategies.
Dhaliwal has struck out on her own. But as protests push society to deal with systemic racism, there are still people trying to change environmental organizations from within. Samia Dumbuya just started a job with international nonprofit Friends of the Earth. She's Black.
I like to talk to people about the role of colonialism and how the West exploiting the lands of Asia, Africa, and Latin America and specific islands, where they basically degraded the environments in those lands and it left people with nothing.
She thinks big environmental organizations can work together with smaller, newer groups, learn from each other, and from the Black Lives Matter movement about how to use social media better to connect with younger, more diverse supporters. She's talked about these tactics in workshops for environmental activists in the past.
Just to show an example of like, hey guys, you do know there's an alternative way of doing this. And look how successful they are as well. We don't have to stick to this old traditional methods of activism.
It's been almost 40 years since Dorceta Taylor's white university professor told her that Black people didn't care about the environment. As she watches the protests for racial equity across the world, she's seeing young people change the environmental movement, push forward the ideas she's been thinking about her whole career, and draw connections between race and the environment, noticing the same parts of cities that are overpoliced and lack public investment are the same parts that have worse air quality and contaminated drinking water.
They're connecting the dots. Breonna Taylor, George Floyd, all these names, they immediately connect that with environmental justice, with climate, with health, because they see it going towards the same neighborhood. Whereas older people are still saying, what does race have to do with environment? I don't see how it's connected. The young people see it.
Those young people may start their own organizations or work within existing ones. Either way, Taylor argues, they're changing the movement for the better. For the World, I'm Anna Cusmer.
Economy bean soup, egg-free, butter-free, and yeast-free peanut butter bread sounds like something you'd whip up if you have not ventured out to the grocery store in a few weeks. There are also recipes that Glenn Powell has been cooking up in Toronto on his YouTube channel.
Welcome, friends. Welcome back to the kitchen. It is Sunday morning, so we're doing another edition of the Old Cookbook Show. Today we're going to do a recipe out of A Guide to Good Cooking from Five Roses Flour. Now, this is the 1938 edition.
Since early 2019, Glenn has been sharing recipes from old cookbooks, including many from the Great Depression era. But in the age of coronavirus, these recipes have taken off big time. Glenn Powell joins us from Toronto. What drew you to these old recipes in the first place, and where are you pulling them from?
What drew me to these recipes is nostalgia. I remember my grandmother cooking this way. I'm a little bit older, so I do remember these recipes showing up when I was a child. And we found initially all of these recipe books in our attic. We had collected them from our grandparents because none of our other family members wanted them.
You've been sharing some of these recipes since early last year. Some of them have recently gone viral, this butter-free, egg-free, and yeast-free peanut butter bread. Really
yes.
Caught on. First of all, what does that taste like?
It was one of those recipes that I thought, oh, this is going to be horrible, but let's give it a go because that's part of what the show is about. And it turned out really good. I actually really enjoy it. It's just like banana bread, except peanut butter instead of banana.
So what do you think is leading people to kind of pick up on what you're sharing with them, rediscovering and presumably preparing these old recipes?
Right when, you know, the lockdown started, there was a tiny bit of panic, I think, as people were trying to figure out what was next and what was going to happen. And that's when we started to see an uptick. And I have to believe that part of that is people spending more time at home, not being able to eat at restaurants, having to cook for themselves, and maybe not having a, you know, great background of cooking. And so they were looking for recipes that were a little more simplistic, using things in their pantry. And that idea of depression cooking sort of fit that idea of what people had, what they needed to do now was going to be what their grandparents or great-grandparents did in the 1930s.
And of course, that dovetails with probably why these recipes caught on back during the Depression, because people were looking for ways to save a few bucks. Do you see that kind of dynamic at play now?
I do see it at play now, but some of the recipes from the Depression don't transfer in the same way to the, 2020.
You mean culturally, like people would not be accustomed to some of the things like, I don't know, peanut butter bread.
Peanut butter bread or, creamed brains.
Creamed brains?
Yeah, we did it. We did a video, creamed brains.
Of what animal?
We used sheep because that's what we could get. But the recipe book, wasn't specific on what type of brain you could use.
All right. What does creamed brains taste like?
It was horrible.
So, Glenn, what is a recipe from the Great Depression that you've shared with people that you were happy to see actually holds up after nearly 75 years?
We did a meatloaf recipe from one of my grandmother's cookbooks that, is essentially from the comments section. People are saying, I didn't know that I was still eating Depression food. That's the way my family has always made it. That's the way my family still makes it today. And so you do see some of those recipes that carry forward without change.
So, Glenn, the longer the lockdown lasts, are you going to keep on keeping on with Glenn and Friends cooking, or are you looking forward to the day when you can get to a grocery store without a mask and just buy anything you want?
I am looking forward to that day when I can go out. even just to sit down in a restaurant would be absolutely wonderful at this point, wouldn't it? I think everybody's aching for that because food is a social gathering point for everybody, and I think that's what has brought people to the YouTube channel, is that yearning for sort of a social connection around food.
Glenn Powell makes vintage Canadian recipes on his YouTube channel, Glenn and Friends Cooking. He joined us from Toronto. Great to meet you, Glenn. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
The Black Lives Matter movement is at work in Europe, highlighting issues for people of color across the continent. For one musician in Italy, that issue is citizenship and who actually gets to call themselves Italian. Angelica Marin has more from Rome.
When you have a message of protest, you take it to the People's Square. It's a piazza crowned with statues and churches smack in the center of Rome. In recent weeks, a wave of young Italians gathered here, people of all colors, 6 feet apart, wearing face masks, down on one knee with their fist in the air. Fight against racism in Italy has a central demand. Young black Italians want to become citizens, plain and simple. You see, they were born in Italy, they were raised on pasta, they went to school here. But because their parents are immigrants, they were denied citizenship at birth. By law, they are second-generation foreigners. Enough is enough, activist and singer Anna Maria Gagne tells the crowd. They know her better by her stage name, a tribute to her cause.
I'm Karima Tuji.
Her name Karima means kind and generous, and Tuji stands for second generation.
I do music to send a message and to express an anger and the need to be recognized as an Italian, but also as a black woman in Italy.
Karima's style is called Bantu Juke Fever, a mix of techno, hip-hop, reggae, Chicago juke, and grime. Her family roots are in Liberia, but her stories come from Italy. This song slams an Italian senator who compared Italy's first ever black government minister, a woman, to an ape. Karima says she has been called the N-word. As a young black woman in Rome, she says she had to explain herself a lot. Twice the police held her at a bus stop, assuming she was an African prostitute. She sings about policing in this song. Karima's art stirs uncomfortable conversations, but she knows how to get people to listen. Like when she opened a concert for American rapper Azalea Banks in Milan in 2015 and wrapped herself in an Italian flag in front of 20,000 people.
And I remember the crowd looking at me like, oh my God, she's doing that. The black girl wearing the Italian flag, so it was very provocative. And I explained the reality of the second generation. The crowd was completely silent. So I remember leaving the stage and this guy came to me and told me, I apologize. I never knew that you guys were going through a lot of struggle. Yeah.
In Italy, there are 1 million second-generation foreigners. They can try to become Italian citizens when they turn 18, but the odds are stacked against them, says Guido Tintori, an expert in European immigration policy at the Fieri Research Center in Turin.
They have to produce proof of continuous, uninterrupted, and legal residence in Italy since birth, which is very, very demanding, especially because their legal status is not dependent on them. It's dependent on their parents, but also on the Italian bureaucracy and the Italian laws about immigration.
If their visa expired at any point, their application will be rejected. When most European countries relaxed their nationality laws in the 1990s, Italy went in the other direction. And while it's difficult for second-generation youth born in Italy to become Italians, it's easy for pretty much anyone on the planet with blood ties to Italy to claim citizenship. If you live in New York or Tokyo and your great-grandpa was Italian, there's a pathway.
Italian identity is profoundly based on whiteness.
Angelica Pesarini is Black Italian and a professor of race and gender studies at NYU in Florence. Her ancestors came from Somalia and Eritrea, where Italy had colonies during Mussolini's fascist era. Pesarini says this period in history has had a lasting effect.
Being Black and Italian, for some, is a sort of oxymoron. If Italians are white, all the Black bodies we see, they don't belong. They must come from somewhere else. So we're not too interested in their rights.
Musician Karima Tuji stepped into that backdrop. Song after song, she's pushing Italy to re-examine its relationship with race, inviting Italian people of color to organize.
I think we are living a very historical moment right now. A lot of people are still experiencing racism. But I think that we can come together and kind of create also a sort of leadership. So this is my main goal right now, to empower myself, to empower like women most of all, because I believe in women, and gain also a Black loyalty, an Italian Black loyalty.
Karima Tucci's message has been out for a few years.
No justice, no peace. No justice, no peace.
But now, she and the second generation are riding the global wave and calling for change. For the world, Angelica Marin, Rome.
Finally today, while the global infection rate for the coronavirus continues to rise, some countries have already started the healing process. Italy was once the epicenter of the outbreak in Europe, but it has successfully managed to flatten the curve, but not without a lot of pain and sadness. Italians said farewell yesterday to victims of COVID-19. A memorial was held at the cemetery of Bergamo, the hardest-hit province in Italy. President Sergio Mattarella spoke at the event. The mayors of Bergamo's 243 cities and towns were also there. A live orchestra played the unfinished Requiem funeral mass by Gaetano Donizetti. He was one of Italy's most important 19th-century composers and a Bergamo native. The soloists and the conductor, the members of the chorus, all wearing face masks. The wind instruments were arranged behind plexiglass. One of the invited guests of the concert was Luca Fusco, a Bergamo native who lost his father in the pandemic. Fusco said the fact that many family members of coronavirus victims were not able to attend was like a wedding without spouses. But he said he hoped President Mattarella's presence would give the grieving families some hope and some strength. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH here in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you back here tomorrow.